Okay, good morning. Happy New Year. We're going to get started right now. We've got two things. If you want some follow-up to do from the week, feel free to take that one sheet, which has some ideas for it. You know, no obligation or requirement to do that, but just some follow-up will be from based on our time together today. And there are notes, at least some of the notes for this first section here. So there should be two kind of things that you can pick up. One's going around and the other one's over at the table there. But let me kick us off in prayer and we'll jump in here. Lord, thank you for our time together today. We're thankful for the book of Isaiah. What a rich, gospel-filled book this is. Many truths that, and even as we think about this class, answering this question of whom do we trust in, and how these first 39 chapters really bring that home to bear, that we can trust in you, that we can lean on you, and you display that time and time again. So I pray that this time will not be simply a time filled with technical knowledge and things like that, but it'll be a practical reminder of the one whom we trust in, and that will challenge us in ways that we need it. So be with us now and help us. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, so on your first page there, and this is the class is Who Do We Trust? This is Isaiah. We're going to be looking at the first 39 chapters in Isaiah. And the reason for that is Isaiah typically is broken up into three parts. So 1 through 39 are kind of the first unit. And so it makes sense to look at that first part of it over these next 12 weeks. There's different ways of dividing up those 39 chapters. I'm not pretending like this is the only way. You know, there's a lot of different ways that people can do it, but this is what we'll try here. We'll be looking at chapters 1 through 39. So I would just encourage you to read through those. Read chapters 1 to 39 in Isaiah, and that way you'll get an idea of what we're talking about here. It closes out with, you know, opens, as we'll see, as you see here in the introduction, with an opening to who Isaiah is. And then as it moves through it, then it ends with the answer to this question, in whom do you trust? With the example of Hezekiah. So he's a wonderful example of what that looks like. In some ways he's not so much. But this outline here is what we'll be doing for each week of the class. So today is a little bit different because I wanted to talk through some of the basics about Isaiah, whereas in typical weeks we won't do that. We'll just focus on the section of scripture that we have and talk through that. So I want to try not to spend all of our time just giving the background stuff and then not have any time to actually look at the first 9 verses. So that's the goal. We'll see how well we do with that. But we do want some background information just so you have a context for Isaiah in this book right here. So let's even start with the author. Even as you think about Isaiah, let's just talk to you a little bit about that, will you? Describe, maybe if you want to share even a little bit about the place in Scripture that, or the importance of Isaiah has meant for you in your life. I mean, for who here has Isaiah as a special place maybe in your life, or a book that you refer to in difficult times, or that you look to for hope and help. Just talk to me a little bit about that. Even as you come in here today, what do you know about Isaiah, and what place does he have in your life? Ellen?
His name will be wonderful, Mighty Counselor, Everlasting Father. You know, if someone asks you, who's Jesus? There he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Good. Yeah, Kelly?
1 year, I had just secular cards to send out, so I wrote out Isaiah 9:11, I believe it is.
Okay.
And I like to start my prayer with that for adoration. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Good. That's great. So I heard a couple mentions to Isaiah 9. What other maybe notable chapters, verses in Isaiah do some of you like or hold to or refer to?
I am the man of unclean lips, is that?
Yeah, chapter 6, yep. Yeah.
41, fear not, for I am with you.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Good. Okay, well, hopefully the goal of these next 12 weeks here will be you'll have more familiarity with the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, and it won't be so impersonal, but it'll connect closer to home. I mean, I want to keep driving that question and keep putting that in your mind, in whom do you trust? Because that is the question that these first 39 chapters really wrestle with. Well, the entire book, yes, but especially these first 39 chapters. So I like these classes to be very interactive, so it's not just me like talking the whole time. This first week might feel a little bit different in the sense of we have to talk through some of the background, but we try to bring in discussion as much as we can. So what I would encourage you to do, even just in like preparation, would be so you have the chapters there that each lesson will cover, to at least skim through those chapters, try to get an idea of what will be covered, what those chapters will be covering. If there's particular questions that you may have, you can write those down. I don't know that we'll be able to talk about every single question, because we might not make it through anymore if we do that. But maybe some of your bigger questions in there, love to hear from everybody on those. So, but today we'll be looking at the first 9 verses, Lord willing, anyway. But let's start with the author here. Okay, so the opening words of Isaiah even talk about that. This is the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amozar. So we don't, Jeremiah talks a lot, or we should say relatively more, about his personal life. Like Jeremiah 20, verses 7 to 12, but not Isaiah. So we don't really have a lot to go off of with what Isaiah is telling us about himself. We have chapter 6, which is his call to prophecy. That's probably his most inmost thoughts on that, on his calling there. We have chapter 7 and 8 and 20, and then 37 to 39 that are giving us some glimpses into his public ministry. We have 2 Kings 19 to 20 that provide us with a little bit more information here, just in terms of his public ministry. But we don't have a lot necessarily on his own personal take on things so much. The New Testament gives, it points out his prophetic ministry. We have John 12, 37 to 41. So he has that foresight. He was given the ability by the Lord to reveal truths to God's people. We know that he was also bold, Romans 10, 20. But the Bible's not so much interested in, what was Isaiah thinking, and let's talk about his personal life, and so on and so forth, and what kind of hobbies did he have, that kind of thing. It's really focused on his message, and even his name, Yahweh is Salvation, really captures that. So that's what the Bible is focused on, not so much Isaiah, but his message. So again, we don't know a whole lot about him other than his dad, which is who was mentioned in the first verse there. Now, Jewish tradition, and John, maybe you could speak to that if you want, would say that his father was a brother of Amaziah, king of Judah, so that would have put him into the royal family. But other than that, not a whole lot about his lineage there. He was married, he was a father, so if you look at, when we get to Isaiah 7:3, chapter 8, verse 3, chapter 8, verse 18, you can see those truths there, so that he was married, that he had at least one child. He seems to have been a resident of Jerusalem. Now, Hebrews 11:37, when it talks about there were silent too, a lot of people think that that alludes to his death. So there's the tradition there that he was sovereign too under the persecution of Manasseh, the king of Judah. But we're not 100% sure of that. So he's presented even in the title. It says the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz. And so Isaiah himself saw the Lord. We'll see that in chapter 6. But so there, he shared, or you could say, his insights, and he put those in a written message. The words that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw, chapter 2, verse 1. So it's a vision that reveals through symbols, through reason for it, a very God-centered way of seeing life, of living. And it gives us a very, it gives us actually the best alternative to the false appearances of this world. So if you want to know the reality, the true reality of life, the true reality of the world, it's to see it through God's lens, God's perspective, and Isaiah is that introduction into that. This book is often called the Fifth Gospel, and as we go through it, there's certainly a lot of those themes in there of the servant, the suffering servant, you know, who that refers to. I'd considered talking about that right now, but it seems that as we go through that we'll bring that out, so I won't say too much about that at this particular time. But it's a very gospel-centered letter. In terms of the date, don't want to really spend a lot of time on that, because I'm sure that that's not something you're going to go back home and think about. But it does say that his ministry started in the year that King Uzziah died, around 740-ish B.C., and he lived long enough to recall the date to the death of Sennacherib, which would be 681 B.C. So it seems that most of the material can only be dated in pretty general terms. The book doesn't give the exact dating to this. So somewhere he's living somewhere 700-ish years before Christ, in that time range. The big theme of the book would be God himself, who does things for his own sake. And so Isaiah is going to define everything in relationship to God, whether it's rightly related to him or wrongly related to him. He's going to show us how God is the Holy One of Israel. He's high and lifted up, but at the same time, he dwells with the contrite, he dwells with the lowly, he's sovereign over the world, his wrath is fierce. But his cleansing anoints us, atones for our sin. He's got salvation and endless supply. His gospel is good news of happiness, which is moving toward the history of the blessing of his people and the world, the worship that the world owes him. But Isaiah's going to show us that God is the only Savior that the whole world will know. And he's going to show that all the promises rest in, all the promises that we have rest in the Lord. And so to delight ourselves in the Lord would be a refreshing feast, and to serve him is a worthy devotion, but to rebel would be endless death. So there's a small glimpse of the book's message here, in even as we start in chapter 1, verse 2, through chapter 2, verse 5. So it's kind of like a little preview for what the whole rest of the book will include in that short section right there. This is how it's going to work. The Lord's going to start out with a case against his people. He's going to say, I've given you a lot. You've had a tremendous privilege from me. You should be grateful children for that. But what are you doing? You've despised me. You're turning away from me. And then he's going to talk about the judgments that they're going to face for the purpose of bringing them to repentance, or at least to preserve a remnant who will repent. Now, thinking back through my history here, I know we've had different classes, and you may have taken some of them, you may not have, but even as we start thinking of, when we talk about this, we have the northern 10 tribes, which would be Israel. We have the southern 2 tribes, which would be Judah. Okay, so we have that split that happens after Solomon's death with Rehoboam. We have the northern 10 tribes going their own way, the southern 2 tribes, which are still holding to David and the promise of the coming Davidic king, and the southern 2 tribes. And so the books of Kings and Chronicles can be confusing, because they can jump back from Kings, of Israel to Judah, to Israel to Judah. And sometimes the kings have the same name, so it gets confusing. You think, I thought I read about this one before. Maybe you did, but maybe it's not the same guy. That's talking about the king of Israel, and we're in Judah here. Okay, so that part can be a little bit challenging. Just to keep that clear, we're talking Isaiah, who is in Judah. Israel, the Northern Ten Tribes are going to come against Judah here. Judah has been more willing to observe the sacrifices by the Lord, but their hearts are far from God. You know, Israel goes into captivity and fails much more quickly than Judah does. Their kings are, for the most part, very bad, very wicked, and so they don't last as long as Judah does. But eventually, Judah will go into captivity right here. So just keeping that concept in mind as you think about the book of Isaiah. You'll see parts addressed to Judah, you'll see parts addressed to the southern part and then to the northern part. And so just being aware of the difference there will be important. So there in the notes we have those themes that you'll see throughout this book. And I'm not going to go through all those here, but you can just take a look at those and read through those as you'd like. You can see there's, again, just a number of different themes throughout this letter right here of what God is going to do. Any questions so far? Any thoughts so far? Okay, so let's finish with the background and then move into that first section here. So Isaiah is coming with this very surprising plan of grace and glory for these rebellious people. And not only for these people, but for the entire world. So if you remember back to the promises that God made to Abraham, one of those promises was that one day the whole world would be blessed. Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3. And so God had promised that through David's throne, it would lead the world into salvation. 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant. Psalm 89, 19 to 37. Those are great promises. And so the people are clinging on to that hope right there. But by Isaiah's time, it just doesn't seem like these descendants of Abraham and the dynasty of David is going to be really aligned with God's promises. And it seems like they are wanting to align themselves with other world leaders. A situation will come up, life will get hard, they'll get scared, and then they'll want to go to Egypt. They want to go to Assyria. They want to go somewhere else. So in terms of being faithful to the Lord, they have not done a really good job at that. There's a little unbelief here in Judah. And Isaiah sees that as moving their future away from blessing. He sees that as moving their future toward punishment, toward this exile. And so there's a very great turning point that's coming here. What's going to happen? Are they going to remain independent? Are they going to remain under God's power? Or will they become under the rule and authority of other pagan powers? And that's where this book is really leading them, is they're moving away from God, and they're moving to really put themselves in a place where pagans will be ruling over them. But it raises a question. So we have Judah and Judah's sin, we have God and his promises. The question is, are God's promises going to be defeated by Judah's sin? That's the question. And no, Isaiah is not the only righteous person here. It's not like there's just him and every single other person was wicked. So I'm sure there's a remnant at least of other faithful believers here. And so they'd be asking that question too. And Isaiah's writing that to encourage them and to help them through this. And so he's going to answer that question. He's going to give an opening in the first five chapters. Then, and starting in chapter 6 through 27, his answer is going to begin to unfold. And the rest of the book will really develop that. It's a very serious but hopeful message of how God's grace will overrule the purposes that even Judah has. It will begin with Isaiah himself in chapter 6. It will spread to Judah in chapter 7 through 9 and Israel. And then it results in endless joy. And the nations of the world will be taken into account. And God will glorify himself through the renewed and increasing glory of his people, which will then attract the nations. So this book of Isaiah is really a book of renewed hope for sinners. It promises the Messiah. It gives hope for the ransomed people of God. It points them to a world in which sin and sorrow will be forever forgotten. So a lot of hope in this book. And then there's three other historical settings right there. So chapters 1 through 39, that's late 8th century BC. That's the background that's going on there. That's what we'll be looking at. Chapters 40 through 55, they're in exile at this point. Okay, so that'd be the 6th century. And then chapters 55 to 66, we take the returned exiles and the fallen generations of God's people as the backdrop right there. So that's a really brief outline. And again, for our purposes, we'll be looking at the first 39 chapters. Okay, any questions, any thoughts as we consider those things so far? No? Okay, well, fair enough. Okay, so again, I think there's a single thing that really wraps up the first 37 chapters of Isaiah, and that would be the king who reigns. So the king who reigns. So kind of keep that theme in mind as you look at the first 37 chapters of Isaiah. Now, that's a very complex theme. Sometimes that king is the Lord himself, as we'll see in chapter 6. Sometimes that king is the current king of the house of David, as you see in chapter 7. Sometimes that king is the king who is yet to come, chapter 9, verses 6 to 7. Okay, so there's sort of this tension. The future is interceding, intersecting with the present. There's the coming reign of the Lord. There's talking about the king being in David's line. And so, it's how do we understand all of those different tensions right there? How do we make sense of all that? Is the future and the present kind of all connect with each other and intersect? Well, even if we don't necessarily can't figure all of that out, this book really excites us. There's such a breadth. There's such a glory to Isaiah's message. As you read those chapters, don't you just get that? Like, wow, this is just tremendous to hear how he talks about the Lord and to see these promises and to see how the Lord is working, even when all hope is lost. So my hope will be that for you, that as you read through this book, that especially the first 39 chapters, that it will continue to invigorate your heart and excite you with the breadth and the glory of the message that Isaiah has. So, now, what I'm going to do for reading is I don't want to put anybody on the spot, so I'll just ask for volunteers. Would somebody be willing to read our first 9 verses here from chapter 1? Joe, you do that? Okay, thank you.
The vision of Isaiah, son of Amos. I'm using the TLV, Real Life Version.
Okay.
Which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah, a nation sick with sin. Listen, heavens, and hear, earth, for Adonai has spoken. Sons I have raised and brought up, that they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its master and the donkey its manger, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Oy, a sinful nation, a people weighed down by iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons dealing corruptly. They have abandoned Adonai, they have despised Israel's Holy One, they have turned backwards. Where will you be struck again as you stray away more and more? The whole head is sick, the heart faint. From the foot to the head there is no sound. Wounds, bruises, raw sores, not pressed, nor bandaged, nor softened with oil. Your land is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your fields strangers devour it in your presence, a desolation overthrown by strangers. So the daughter of Zion is left as a sukkah in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Unless Adonai Tzavot had left a small remnant, we would have been in Sodom or we would have been in Gomorrah.
Yep, perfect. Thank you. Yep, thank you, thank you. Okay, so what I'd like to do, in the future is, if you're able to read it in advance, then it gives you an opportunity to think about it, consider it, come with more engagement, I guess. But we'll, so it's not fair to you that we're necessarily, that we're just jumping in and talking about it, but that's okay. We'll do it anyway. So the opening section of this chapter, the way that the book opens, it opens really with this. You have the introduction to who Isaiah is, okay? And then it gives this charge against Israel. So God as the judge is giving this charge against Israel. So what were some of the charges that God is bringing against Israel here?
They rebelled against him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sinful.
Sinful, yep. Don't miss verse 4. There's something important in there, too.
Forsake him.
Forsaken, yeah. Yep. So the forsaking of the Lord has then led to this brokenness, this desolation. So that's good. That's just, again, a really key reminder right there. Like, what happens when we forsake the Lord? Well, that's what it leads to, this brokenness and this desolation. So there's a couple of ways to divide this up. How you do it is not super important, but the two guys we'll take a look at in verses 2 and 3, God is the one who is opening up things. You know, he's the one who's bringing the charge against the people here. And then in the second one, 4 through 9, we have Isaiah, who is expanding on that. He's going to look at Israel and their condition, and he's going to expand on that charge. So even from the opening, it's an invitation. He says, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken." Okay, so it's an invitation to come and listen in. So listen in to see what God has to say to these people here. Now, even as you see that, it's not a discussion, is it? God's not saying at this particular point, "Hey, let's get to the table. I'd like to hear from you, see what you have to say. Come with my thoughts, what I have to say. We'll work out some kind of agreement here." This is what we would call one of those divine monologues. So when God speaks, you know we better listen. And the heavens and the earth are called the here. And so God is really meditating on what we could say is a very strange situation that has developed. Now, by strange, I don't necessarily mean that God has been caught off guard by this, that God doesn't know what's going on, but strange in the sense that rationally it doesn't make sense. Okay, so help me understand here, Lena. What to you seems strange about the situation? Even as you look at verses 2 and 3, what would be the strangeness to this situation?
Despite the fact that they know, they don't know.
Okay.
The Lord reared these children, the nation.
Okay.
They mm-hmm. know his word, mm-hmm. and yet they've still turned against him, and they do not understand,
mm-hmm.
even though they've got the understanding available to them.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Other thoughts?
I don't know. The saying, "Don't look a gift horse in the mouth," comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's like, they're, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we'll see, this does seem to be a very unique situation. It's very personal to the Lord. The covenant that he's made is very much in the background that he's made with his people. But their offense is really against what we could say would be common sense. So they are rebelling against even common sense. So in other words, those first couple verses are really pointing out that the animals know who they belong to. And you're a person, which would mean that you're smarter than an animal, and you can most of us, and we can paint and we can bring these in. So why are we acting like worse than the animals? You're rebelling against your owner. The animals don't even do that. Like, what is wrong with you? That doesn't make any sense. That's kind of what Isaiah is doing, or what the Lord's doing in that first section right there. It reminds us a lot of Deuteronomy 32:1. Would somebody be able to look that up? I'll give two verses. Deuteronomy 32:1. Anyone got that? Are you willing to look that up? Yeah. Chris? Okay. And then Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. Somebody do that for us, please. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. Karen? Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So, yep.
32:1.
Mm-hmm.
Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak. Hear, O earth, the words of my mouth.
Okay. So it takes us back to even there in Deuteronomy, when the Lord is doing the same thing there, calling for the heavens to hear. Okay.
I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your offspring may live.
Yeah, thank you. So clearly, by referencing back to Deuteronomy, he's going back to the covenant right there. And then in this context, he's calling on the heavens and earth to witness whether it was the blessings or the cursings of the covenant. And so here the covenant has been broken, the curses are falling on its people. And so it would be expected here that Israel and Isaiah are aware of this. I mean, it's the same type of language there. So Jeremiah uses covenantal language a lot more out in the open. He's a lot stronger in the way that he words it. Isaiah doesn't use the word for covenant, but certainly Isaiah knows about that. It's very important to him. It's the grounds of his thinking. The Lord is appealing to, or calling for the heavens and earth, he's just reminding them that this is how life is supposed to work right here. What God's people are doing is an offense against nature, in other words. The animals don't even do this. So they're going against nature. Sin, pride, oppression, that's contrary to creation, the way that God envisioned it. And like we talked about, the donkey, it's intelligent enough to know who it belongs to, who it can depend on. But think about that. God's children are acting like they can't. They're going the opposite of that. So the stars and the earth, they're following obediently in the world. We don't have like rogue, you know, stars that are just like, oh, I don't want to do that, Lord. I want to go my own way. Of course not. Those things work in a way that they're designed to, but not humans. So it's a direct appeal to people. It's neat how God uses so many different ways and means of getting us to think, to change our thinking, to change our feeling, to change our acting, right? He doesn't always just go about it one way. Sometimes he goes about it like in the way that he does here. Like, look around you. Look at the animals. They're not doing that. Why are you doing that? And it's meant to remind his people that their relationship is a parent-child type of relationship here. So it's really important. I mean, God is their father. They've rebelled against him. So the Hebrews there would see God in the role of nurturing and rearing. And that would make rebelling against him all the more unnatural. So to go against somebody who has engendered you, which would be, as the pagans would view, you know, their typical view of gods, they would see that more in terms of begetting. But like I said, the Hebrews, it was nurturing and rearing. So they would see that component of it as you think about God. So if you would refuse to submit to the one who, in a sense, we could say produced you, that would be bad enough. But to refuse to submit against the one who has cared for you would be even worse. So Isaiah there is really continuing to strengthen his depiction of this unnatural characteristic of sin by referring to the animals. The ox, these type of animals would not have been considered very intelligent by the people here, but they were intelligent enough to there with Tantra there. So shouldn't Isaiah, or shouldn't Angel be able to do better than these unintelligent animals? But sadly, no, they weren't. Now we know that Israel had a very unique relationship with the Lord. It came out of experience, direct experience with Him in Egypt and at Sinai. It was revealed through this covenantal relationship. And so that knowledge of the Lord wasn't wasn't limited to just intellectual knowledge. There was a relational component of this knowledge. There was a personal component of this knowledge. And even as we think about the world out there, okay, I'll just say out these doors, even as you look around, one should be able to submit to the Lord by looking at the world around and seeing, and even wrestling with that question, why are things here? How did they get here? Did they just appear by accident? So on and so forth. And we know that Romans teaches that we're without excuse. All people have that knowledge of God, that there is a creator. So there should be that sense in which we, if you're just looking around, and you should be able to realize, oh, God put these things here. God put these things here. They're not here by accident or by fate or by chance. But how much more when one has personally experienced the Lord's care and help, should that lead to submission and obedience? Right? I mean, it's one thing if you didn't experience the personal connection with that, there'd still be that responsibility, right? You're not off the hook. It should lead you to obedience and submission to Him. Even just looking around and seeing the marvels of creation, but even more so, if you've had a personal relationship with Him and you've seen Him do these things, like there should be so much more obedience and love and so on and so forth with that. And that's just not what's happening here. So Isaiah, you could say, believed that the people should be able to reflect on life as deeply as the animals could. And even more so, because they're not animals, they're people. So those are the first, we could say, three verses right here, is what's happening there. This God is bringing this personal complaint against His people, and He's pointing out the strangeness of what they're doing. The animals are not even doing this. So then we get to verses 4 through 9. And looking back to those, this is when Isaiah then begins to expand on what the Lord has said. He puts more language in there, more imagery in there, and begins to flesh that out. As you look at those verses there, look... what do you think the attitude is of the Lord? In other words, do you think that the Lord is saying these things with a celebratory attitude, a glory, a celebration? He's angry. He's angry, okay. Uh-huh. Anything else? Huh?
Yeah, He's speaking the truth in love.
Okay.
I mean, this is how you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you flip ahead a little bit to chapters 13 and 14, judgments here on Babylon in those two chapters, but there, especially in chapter 14, you actually have this taunting of Babylon that's happening. There's this glory, there's this, almost in a sense, this taunting against them. For example, 14:4, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Now, I'm sure some of you are looking forward to getting into that, especially as you look at 12 through 20 right there, or whatever, who that's referring to, but we'll just have to wait till we get there. But that type of celebration is not happening here in this opening, okay? The Lord is not taunting his people. There's not this glory. I think there's more sadness. There's more grief that's being expressed here. So Isaiah is seeing the condition of his people. He knows that that's what's to be expected. I mean, that's what happens, but he's not happy about it. He's not doing that because he's taking delight in it. Verse 4. Turn over to verse 4. Look at the language even that Isaiah uses there. Very poetic, very hard-hitting. He's got such a great way of moving in those words that really strengthen the point that he's trying to make. I mean, he could have just said, you're one of one big group of simple people here, and that would have been true. But look at the way he poetically fleshes that out to give an even deeper picture of that. A people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly, forsaken the Lord, despise the Holy One of Israel, they are utterly estranged. So Isaiah, you know, certainly is very poetic in what he says, and able to bring home some of these things to life in some very helpful ways. He starts even here with this cry, "Ah, sinful nation," right there. And that is a cry of desolation that is quite frequent here in the first part of Isaiah. So if you want to flip ahead a couple places, just put your finger there and we'll take a look at that. But chapter 5, verse 8. A wail right there. It's the same type of thing. Chapter 6, verse 5. He does the same thing right there. And he said, "Woe is me." So that's fairly common here in the first part of Isaiah, this cry of desolation. So when you hear that, when you hear the word woe, what comes to your mind?
Troubles.
Troubles, yeah. Yeah.
Sorrows,
yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, grief and gore and death. So it's not a good thing to be starting off with a woe or an ah like that. It's a sign of trouble. The ESV version, a lot of translations have that ah. It's probably better to say something more like alas. You know, we don't really say that in our language anymore. In fact, I can't even think of the last time I've heard somebody say that. Alas. You know, but that's probably more, it probably captures the meaning of what he's trying to say there better. Like, it's this woe, it's this, oh no, this is really not good here. So he's looked at the natural world, he's talked about the animals, he's compared the people to them, none are favorable light. Now he's going to shift and give a very direct description of the people, of their condition. They're sinful. They're corrupt. They've forsaken the Lord. So we can learn some things from that. So to be sinful would be to spurn the Lord. Right? As you think about what is sin, how does that manifest itself? Well, that is what it is to be sinful. It's to spurn the Lord. But the opposite is that true, right? What's it look like to be faithful? Well, it's to cling to the Lord, to trust him, not to spurn him. So it points out, he's pointing out there that connection between our moral life and our relationship to God. If we're trying to live a moral life without submission to the one from whom morality stems, that's a form of pride. We can't do that. But on the other hand, how do you move through sin and evil, guilt and corruption? Well, there has to be this link between the Lord. So you have to have that as well. You can't do it just through morality. You have to have a relationship with the Lord. But on the other hand, If they're just trying to, do the morality thing on their own, that's not going to work either. So Isaiah here is really laying out this these first nine verses kind of like some karate chops, if you think about it like that. He's giving these little short sayings that are hitting home like karate chops or short jabs or punches. He says things like, "Woe, sin nation, get rid of the people, evil generation, corrupt people." I mean, so it's like he's hitting them, making his point right there. They're wrestling away, not just a one-time thing, but regularly, habitually. They have this perverted character, this iniquity, this guilt that's resulted in their straying. As a family, they're living really the opposite of what family life is to be like. So they're not dependent on the one from who they should be. They're going their own way. As a people, as a family, they've lost their way. So what's happened here? What does Isaiah give as the reason for this in these first nine verses here?
I don't know. Are they becoming self-reliant and lukewarm?
Yeah. Well, that's fair.
Thank you. Those of you from going to second service, you'll get that.
Yeah.
I mean, NIV has, in verse 5, talks about the whole head is injured, the whole heart is afflicted.
And
it says from foot to head. Verse 6, there's no soundness.
Yep. They've forsaken the Lord. And so that word there, it's a word that's used in divorce. So in a sense, they've divorced the Lord, so to speak. And as a result of this, it's no wonder they're having issues. Because righteousness can only be found in Him. It can only come, as it were, rightly related to Him. It's not this independent possession that any of us have. It's not like we can have righteousness and then be disconnected from the Lord and go our own way. It doesn't work like that. It only comes, it's only because it's only in the Lord and through a relationship with Him. Right? That's the only way that that works. And so by forsaking the Lord, they've now cut themselves off from righteousness. And the righteousness they thought they had, it's not there. And so this is the first appearance of the Holy One of Israel. But even just in the way that, think about the way that Isaiah describes the Lord right there. He could have just said the Lord. So what do you think is the significance of the Holy One of Israel?
I just look at, I keep looking at that, a people laden with iniquity, and I just think of my own sin and how we are all laden with iniquity and how hopeless that is apart from the Holy One of Israel. So that's our only hope right there.
Yep, good.
I think comparing that sin to a holy God just brings that chasm so vividly to mind.
The one that makes us holy.
Yeah. Yep. So to understand ourselves rightly, we have to first understand God rightly. Right? You can't understand yourself or your condition if you don't understand God first. So by understanding God correctly makes sense then why their sin is so disgusting and so bad. He's the Holy One. There's no other God for them. He's the only one who's worthy of their worship. He's the only one who is truly other, who is truly really not like them, truly different. And so He's committed Himself to Israel. He's good. He's almighty. I mean, all these things are true about God. Think about that. And what has been your response? Well, that's all right. Gentiles. So does that make sense? That's why it's so bad. Because of who God is and what, how they're responding. So all the language used here, it's very similar back to the book of Deuteronomy when it's talking about idolatry. They've, in essence, again, left him for idols. And so that's what Isaiah sees is this rejection of the word. He's seeing that they are attempting to try and control their own destiny apart from God. And when they do that, they're denying God. And so to accept God's way means that they have to frighteningly relinquish their own sense of control. So they are very uncomfortable. It goes back to this question, who will you trust? Okay? They see these things going on. Very uncomfortable. They want to try to grasp it and seize it and take control. In doing that, they're rejecting God. So the antidote to that is to leave behind this, so willingly to relinquish their own power and to accept God's ways. And that's really scary to do. I think that's true with all of us, isn't it? We like to have a sense of control. We like to hold on to things. And it's hard for us to say, oh, man, I can't do that. I've got to release that to the Lord here. So typically, they would try to keep both God and the other gods. That's kind of how Israel worked. It wasn't so much just a straight-out rejection of the Lord as if we don't want anything to do with you. It was kind of like, well, let's take the best of both worlds. So the pagans have, you know, maybe this god, we can bring some of that in while keeping God. So for the most part, it wasn't a conscious abandoning of God, but really, their attempts to do these things were abandonment and rebellion. And so one of the things in Deuteronomy 27-30 is the destruction that happens when you forsake God. So Deuteronomy talks about the covenant curses there. If we live in covenant with him, we experience those blessings, but to break the covenant would be to experience the curses. And that's what Isaiah is talking about, is now Israel is getting ready to experience the results of sin, these covenantal curses. So verses 5 to 6, the metaphor of health. Health is the normal or natural state of the body. But if there's, so you think about a person, right? If somebody walked in with all kinds of wounds and sores and things like that, our first immediate response would be, oh, I don't think they're really healthy. They're fully healthy. Like, that's not natural in that sense. We know that something is wrong. We know that measures need to be taken to combat that unnatural situation. And that's what Isaiah is saying here. He's saying, just as disease, you know, naturally produces certain symptoms, so does rebellion. And these symptoms were present for everyone to see. The nation is desolate. It's stripped. It's forsaken. If you're just using common sense and you're looking around, the first thing that should go off your mind is, this is not good. We need some help. We need a cure. But that's not happening either. And in addition, you know, Israel's health is not just a matter of disease. She has been beaten and smitten. So if you look at verse 6 right there, those talk about injuries that you'd receive in battle, like slash wounds, lacerations, bleeding wounds. They're coming not from an accident that's happened. It's not like Israel got caught up in their own feet and fell on the stairs. Oh man, now they're all banged up. They've received these things because they went to fight with God, right? You pick a fight with God and you're going to get beat up. So just good morning to that. But God is not punishing in an arbitrary way. He's got a purpose in all of this. And so the question that Israel is wrestling with, that Isaiah is wrestling with, is what to make of these sufferings? Are they going to crush her? Are they going to destroy her? And Isaiah knew how hard repentance was for the people here. So we can think about, and I don't think I've heard anybody mention this passage yet, but I'm sure for many of you, Isaiah chapter 53, the suffering servant, is such a key passage. So think about how, in light of what we have happening here, how that shed in some different light, perhaps, on Isaiah 53, of what the suffering servant does there. So what are the sicknesses? What are the pains in which the servant bears? Well, they're those that have been occasioned by the wrong of his people. That's what they are. And so there's a connection between Isaiah 53. We're not going to get to that, but you can, you know, as you're running out at some point, you can think back to chapter 1. So it takes us there for the solution. And then the last two verses, verses 7 to 9, he's moving away from this imagery of a sick and injured person to a conquered land, the desolation that's happening because of that. So he's talking about it. And so the point here is not what the literal picture looks like at the time Isaiah is writing this. The point is the spiritual. This is what's happening. It's a wasteland. So if you're trying to jump in there and think, you know, if Isaiah walked outside the doors of his house, is this what he would literally see? Maybe, maybe not. That's not so much the point. But spiritually, this is what's happening here. Israel's a wasteland. So it's not good. Things are not going well right here. Verse 8, he's using these images of shelters to talk about the desolation, the hopelessness, the result because of Israel's rebellion. So in this time, they didn't have tractors or trucks or things like that, so the farmers would a lot of times live in the villages and then walk out to the farmland, but that can take a lot of time to do that, so they build some little huts that they could stay in during the harvest season right there. And, you know, you think about that. The harvest is gone. The shacks are still there. Very sad picture. They're useless. They're deteriorating. There's nothing good happening there. So Israel's really just a little shack in the vineyard. But verse 9. Okay, so looking back to verse 9 here. This is where there's still hope, though, okay? To the point where it just ended with verse 8. There's no hope there. But go at verse 9. So the Lord of hosts has left them a few survivors. So God could have made his people like Sodom and Gomorrah. He could have completely obliterated them. He could have completely wiped them out. But he doesn't. And that's not an act of weakness, because it's the Lord who did this. But it's he spared a remnant. And so the hope for the people here is that even if, and for Isaiah, is even if he doesn't live to see it, he can still believe that out of a hut in a cucumber patch, God is able to do great things. I love that imagery. A hut in a cucumber patch. Doesn't sound too appealing to me. But even out of that, again, he has the hope that God is able to do great things. And so that's what I'd leave you even today. And so some of the follow-up, they're just idea suggestions, and really follow up on some of the themes that we've talked about here today. So my hope would be, you know, during the week, that as you think about these chapters that we're going to work through, really make connections to your life and to help you wrestle with that question, in whom do I trust? And so you can be in a lot of different places even today as you're coming to this text here. But I think either way, or any way you do it, these texts do have great significance for our lives. And so, for next week, if you want to do that, kind of look through those questions and think through those, and then the focus will be on starting in verse 10 through chapter 5, verse 30, where many of Judah's sins will be confronted right there. Okay, any other thoughts, questions? Okay. Well, thanks for joining us in this class. My hope will be, again, that it will benefit you going forward here. So thanks for coming today. We are dismissed, and take care. Have a good rest of the week.